Welcome to this Thursday opening day in the NFL edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. While fans are buzzing with excitement, athletes everywhere are feeling those familiar pregame jitters, but how do we know when nerves are just part of the game and when they signal something deeper? We'll continue our conversation today with North Dakota sports psychologist Dr. Erin Haugen, and she joins us to break down the difference, offering insights for athletes, parents, and coaches on managing anxiety, building resilience, and preparing for life on and off the field. Plus, we'll visit with Annie Beck from the North Dakota Gateway to Science. And Becky Perdame stops by the Main Street studio. Her new business is Caring Transitions. And of course, it's Thursday, so that means it's time to review the news with our news director, Dave Thompson. And we continue our conversation today with Dr. Erin Haugen. She's a licensed clinical and sports psychologist. She's based in Grand Forks. She works with athletes from the University of North Dakota. She's helped Olympic athletes, and she's also helped school athletes and even athletes who aren't in school. Erin, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me again.
We have so much more to talk about, and I want to start almost where we left off in our previous conversation, talking about parents and athletes. And this is something that I observed in my family. Mm-hmm. Trying to recognize the difference between normal pregame nerves and signs of a more serious mental health concern, because my goodness, the big game, it's a big deal.
Yeah, it's really important. And again, we want to have some level of activation too, right? Like we want, I often tell athletes, if we're as chill as we are just sitting down on the couch and watching our favorite show, chances are we are not going to perform our best because we're going to maybe feel a little bit more subdued. So how I often think about it is after the game or the competition starts, does that anxiety decrease? Are we noticing it staying high or maybe even continuing to increase throughout that competition? Outside of the competition, well, actually even during the competition, are they making, you know, a lot of errors, maybe not performing in the competition like they do in practice? A lot of times that could be an indication that there might be some performance anxiety, which is actually a very, very treatable thing. Anxiety is one of the most treatable things we have in psychology. And those of us that are trained in performance psychology, we know how to handle that a lot. That's actually one of the main reasons people come to speak with us. And beyond sport, there also might be, you know, an anxiety disorder. You know, athletes are not immune to mental health diagnoses. So, you know, is there a lot of worrying about things afterward? Are they finding, you know, less enjoyment in their sports? Are we finding that anxiety spilling over into other things like school and family? What does their sleep look like? I think sleep is probably one of the most important indicators of how someone is doing. And it's also something that can really impact performance if we're not getting quality, restful sleep. And then certainly any signs of, you know, thoughts of self-harm, you know, thoughts of suicide, things like that are really, really important to make sure you connect someone to emergency resources as soon as possible if someone verbalizes those.
Kids are going to win and they are going to lose. Mm-hmm. What should parents keep in mind when helping kids navigate disappointment? It's inevitable in sports. Even I'll say after a win, you were talking about earlier that, you know, you talk about what went well, what didn't go well. And shoot, they could have just had the best game of their life and been dwelling on this one little thing that no one even noticed. And it's driving them bonkers.
Absolutely. I've even had student athletes who've broken school records and are disappointed because they didn't perform to the standard that they want. It's just, that's part of being an athlete.
What should parents keep in mind?
What I actually think is really just don't be afraid to talk about failure. One of the things that I tend to see, athletes get really uncomfortable with the word failure, and we're going to fail at stuff. We're going to have hard things. That's okay. We can do hard. And so I think it's more about how we talk about that disappointment and don't shy away from it. It's completely okay to feel disappointed. All that tells me is that that's something that was really important to you. And how can we learn from that? How can we grow from that? That's the biggest thing in terms of disappointment and failure and, you know, not reaching the outcomes that we want. It's just, you know, how can we have an orientation that keeps us engaged and excited about continuing to work toward those bigger goals that we have for ourselves?
I want to talk about parents of, and I'm going to use this in air quotes, elite athletes. We've talked about that before on this show. Yeah. And these could be kids in the traveling team in middle school or in high school, perhaps. We can argue what the definition of elite means, but we've left that to another Main Street. Now, there could be the case when the parent is more motivated to have success than the athlete. And that can be tough for the little one.
Absolutely.
How can that be navigated successfully?
Yeah. And I've actually had some of those conversations with athletes that maybe their parent is really motivated by them competing at the collegiate level. But the young athlete is like, actually, there's a lot of sacrifices I have to make, and I don't want that. One of the things that I actually really try to empower young athletes with is to really help them understand what is their why. And I also do this for other athletes as well. Like, what drives them? What's important to them? And how can they, no matter what, fall back on what's important to them? So, for example, one of the things that I hear a lot from younger athletes, elite or not, their relationships with their teammates are actually really, really important. And so how can we make sure that we're having good relationships with our teammates no matter what? No matter what the pressure is, no matter how we're performing. Because if we're centering those things that are important to us, win, lose, pressure, not pressure, it'll matter, but we're investing in the thing that's really, really important to us. And so I think it's helping young athletes and even older athletes understand that. And sometimes also, you know, being able to empower them with having conversations with their parents about what their goals are and how those might be different for them too could be beneficial.
And sometimes tough.
Absolutely. Probably tough. I mean, it's tough for all of us to have hard conversations.
Sure,
And I think that's where, you know, even being able to seek out, you know, the help of a sports psychologist could be really beneficial. I've had facilitated lots of those conversations. And, you know, I think even for parents, just being able to letting go of that dream is also hard for parents. It's just, you know, those things shifting and realizing, gosh, like, I was really looking forward to them playing at this elite level and they don't want to do that. That is disappointing. That's okay.
I lived it. I'm sorry.
So yeah, my daughter
was an all-state soccer player, probably yep. Division II quality player,
yep.
And had a recruiting trip. The coach had been bugging her for a long time and okay, yep. We're going to go. It started to snow. Uh-huh. And I said, we can still make it. Come on, let's go. And the response was, Dad, I don't want my college to be like that.
Yeah. Yep.
And for right? a few hours, mm-hmm. I couldn't believe it yep. that she was not wanting to take advantages of those opportunities, but it wasn't my life. It was hers. I figured yeah. that out, you yeah. know, a few hours later and off we went. But yeah. sometimes I think that goals for parents are different mm-hmm. than goals from kids. And yeah. again, reaching out for someone like you is helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I also think too, being able to put in perspective that if the goals aren't driven by the athlete, it's not going to work. Their motivation level is going to suffer. Their effort level is going to drop. And so that's why being able to have it athlete-centered as much as possible can be helpful. And again, like it that's the hard part about being a parent and being in a, you know, kind of an adult with perspective is like we might have an idea about what that trajectory might look like. But I've worked with so many athletes over the years who have decided to retire for several reasons before their eligibility is finished. And truly, I don't know that I've ever worked with a student athlete who has regretted the decision to retire if we've talked about it from a lot of different angles and they know why they're choosing to retire.
Talked about team culture. Mm-hmm. Is the good mental health of a team harder to achieve than the good mental health of the individuals on the team?
That is such a good question. You know, I think it's different. Because so many different people, you have so many different personalities and so many different perspectives and so many, I mean, just even on a basic level of introverts and extroverts, you know, the introverts might want to just keep to themselves a little bit more and the extroverts might want more connection. And so a lot of it is really just how do we negotiate conflict and how do we negotiate hard conversations? I think we, as long as we fall back on that idea of high challenge and high support, that can be a really great guiding compass for a lot of us. So this idea of high challenge is it's okay to have standards. You know, a lot of times athletes want standards. They want to work toward things. If we don't have standards, it actually gets boring and they kind of check out. And you know, that's reserved for the backyard playing with our friends. So having high standards is wonderful and not a problem done well. High support also means like it's okay to fail. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to, you know, speak up respectfully. And so I think that the best performing teams really do have that combination of high support and high challenge. And we're also creating space for individual differences within that. You know, somebody might be a little bit more quiet. Somebody might, you know, navigate some anxiety. But we can recognize that and have a culture of, you know, if we notice something, we ask them about it. We check in with them about it. And that can be really important.
How can team culture then be built to normalize talking about good mental health rather than hiding it? What can a team do to facilitate that it's okay to talk about this?
I love that question. I think part of it is just simply acknowledging that humans have a range of emotions. Like, I think sometimes in sport, we'll have a really interesting relationship with emotions in sport. Sometimes we want people to play with a lot of emotion, like play with a lot of aggression. You know, certain like collision sports often have, you know, play with a little bit more aggression, understandably so, given their role. But then not necessarily recognize that other emotions like doubt, anxiety, confusion are going to pop up in there as well. And so I think just acknowledging like, yeah, people have a range of emotions. You know, people have hard days and it's okay to have hard days. It's what we do with those hard days that matter. You know, and really encouraging people to take care of themselves. And you know, if you have some stuff that you're bumping into day in and day out that's really limiting you, or you feel like, you know, if you figured it out, that could help you be better, you know, really encourage them to do that. One of the things that I think is kind of tricky for coaches is, you know, that idea of like, I don't want to be their therapist. And by all means, you do not have to be their therapist. I actually encourage coaches to have support with boundaries. You know, train yourself to be an elite noticer for changes in signs and symptoms, and have really great relationships with mental health professionals who specialize in sport, that when you notice those things, you can connect that student athlete to those people. You are not expected to be their therapist. And I would actually encourage you to not be, because then you can focus on being their coach and you can really thrive in that role. And you can still provide support, but you don't have to, you know, walk that full journey and get into the nitty-gritty details of somebody's mental health.
We're enjoying our conversation with Dr. Erin Haugen. She's a licensed clinical and sports psychologist based in Grand Forks, and she's worked with athletes in more than 20 sports, from recreational hacks like me to pros and beyond. So let's talk about high pressure moments. We mentioned before, I think in the last time we visited, the Yips at top levels, college championships, professional playoffs, the Olympics. How do you help athletes manage that moment so nerves don't derail a performance? Think Simone Biles.
Hands down, you prepare for it. You embrace that moment is coming, and you develop a mindset
it's
that invites
coming.
That.
It's yeah, going. It's, oh, wow.
It's on its way. Ugh. And you embrace that. And you train yourself to say, all right, these emotions that I'm feeling right now, this is exactly, it's right on time. This is exactly what I've prepared for and I've trained for, and I can handle these emotions. I actually get goosebumps as I'm saying that. It's really teaching people to not fear those internal experiences that come up for them, not fearing our heart racing, not feeling the mind chatter, that kind of, I like to call it our inner heckler in our head, where it's like, hey, don't mess up. And it's being able to just say, yeah, okay, that's what happens in these big moments. And I know I can do well because of X, Y, and Z, because of that preparation that I've put in, because of my, you know, mental routines. And the fact that this is showing up doesn't mean anything other than this is a big moment.
Beyond sports, we take lessons from our participation in sports. There's a lot of research that says there's great value in participating in sports. What lessons from sports psychology can help the rest of us perform better at work, in school, and in everyday life?
You know, that's actually one of the coolest things about my job, is that, you know, yes, I'm working with elite athletes, and they're also human. And so a lot of these principles are very applicable to the outside world, whether we're talking about being a parent, a good partner, navigating interactions with bosses, managing life's curveballs. And so I think that a huge component of that is really just learning to understand ourselves more, you know, being aware of what are some of those tricky spots that come up for us. What is our mindset around it? Are we thinking about things in a way that's helpful or unhelpful? And then what do we do in response to that? How are we showing up? Are we, you know, I like to call it value-based living. Are we investing in those things that are important to us? Or is that stuff that comes up, the, you know, sensations and the thoughts, or is that pulling us away from the stuff that's important to us? And so I think the more that we can just slow that down and just understand ourselves, and again, it's going to require a little bit of grace, because I think, you know, sometimes it's a little bit humbling to be aware of what shows up for all of us, myself included. Mm-hmm. Having a little bit of grace, having a little bit of curiosity around that, that really helps us try to think through what do we want some of those steps to be. And then also know that there's a bunch of professionals out there that that's literally what we do, is we help people manage those things using, you know, really evidence-based tools for all sorts of things and all sorts of concerns.
Is it ever too early for an athlete, and mm-hmm. I'm talking about middle school and high school, mm-hmm. to start thinking about their retirement, and I use that in air quotes, from competing, because it is such a huge part of mm-hmm. even a high school, even a middle school student's life, certainly a college athlete's life. Mm-hmm. We can prepare to, that we're going to get the yips. I guess we're also going to retire. We're going to end it. Mm-hmm. Do you have kids think about that?
Yes. And I encourage kids to think about that.
And they're going, are you kidding me? I'm going to play forever. I'm Superman. Come on.
It's harder at the middle school level to get them to be able to think in that way, because the abstract thinking is differently developed than somebody who's older. I have a nephew who's in middle school, and that's not where we're at, actually. So, but I actually think it is really important to think about, you know, what else? What else is part of our life? Because if we don't know that, any athlete at any point could have a career-ending injury. Any athlete could have reasons that interfere with their ability to not be on a team. Maybe they're not selected for a team, or maybe they retire for mental health reasons, or, you know, there's, you know, COVID. I don't think anybody anticipated COVID. So a lot of athletes were really disoriented when that hit, because that was just so central to what they do. That's actually something that kind of one of my passion projects is helping athletes really think about that transition to retirement early, build tools, build skills, build resilience, and also empower adults in their life to be able to help them navigate those conversations as well. And so I've been able to do some work with the state of North Dakota around some programming related to that, which is really actually pretty cool to help athletes think about those things, even if it feels weird. That's okay. We do all sorts of, you know, we can do hard things. We can do uncomfortable things. Research actually tells us that when we do think about it sooner, it actually helps us invest in our sport more because we know why that sport's important to us, and we're not stressing about what comes after retirement.
Erin, how do you visit and handle work with an athlete who mm-hmm. was the superstar in yeah. high school? I'm the man. I'm the woman. I'm the big jock in town. And mm-hmm. I come to my school. Mm-hmm. It could be a smaller school, bigger school. And I'm mm-hmm. not anymore. In fact, I'm hardly playing as a freshman. I may breathe a little bit as a sophomore, play a little more later, but I've never had to wait that long in my life. I started as a freshman in high school, for crying out loud. Do you work with folks like that?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Whenever I first meet an athlete, one of the first things we talk about is their sport journey. What does that look like? You know, what were some of those peak moments? What got them into their sport? Why did they love their sport? A lot of times when we go through those role shifts, there's some pieces that we lost connection with, you know, or there's different goals that we need to set. Or also it's just simply learning how to handle that disappointment for the first time. And just what does that mean about me? And how do I interpret that in a way that's helpful and not going to demotivate me? And so a lot of curiosity and different strategies work for different athletes. But I think a huge part of that is just knowing their journey and what's really important to them, and how can we use that to help them be the person and the athlete that they want to be.
One mental health skill that every young athlete should start practicing today would be what?
Oh, it's so hard to pick just one. So many, so many. I think one of the most foundational skills is learning to use your breath as an anchor, as an activation regulation strategy. And then you can add other things onto that, like mindset and visualization and stuff like that. But I think our breath is always with us, and it's so hard for all of us, but athletes especially, to stay present moment focused. And so the breath can really bring us back to the present. We're not too far in the past. We're not stuck in thinking about the mistake. We're not too far ahead thinking about how can I win this game? We're just focused on the moment in front of us. And the breath can be a really amazing component of that done well.
Is that your go-to strategy when you're running your triathlons or in gravel races?
I use a lot of breathing, and I also use a lot of self-talk. One of the things, so I do not like hot weather, and guess what? I race in hot conditions. And so I can very easily get salty and crabby about the fact that it's hot, but that doesn't help me race better. And so, you know, just centering my breath and just going back to like, hey, that's not important. What needs your focus right now? You know, when it's an acronym, what's important now? That can be a really beneficial strategy that I often use when I'm racing.
As we wind up the conversation today, is there a book or a guide or two that you might suggest for parents who have kids at any level, all the levels that we've talked about, middle school, high school, college, that are competing in athletics that would be a good help for them?
A book that I would really recommend is called Parenting Young Athletes, Developing Champions in Sport and in Life. It is by Frank Small and Ronald Smith. It's an older book from 2012, but it's actually got a lot of really wonderful foundational concepts that can just help us start thinking about how to integrate some of these sports psychology concepts into our interactions with our young athletes.
One more quick question, Erin. Mm-hmm. I remember, I think, being told that East Germans had this sports psychology thing down long before we even started to give it some thought. Is the United States level now in terms of how we prepare athletes from a sports psychologist perspective?
You know, we have actually seen amazing strides actually within the sports psychology and mental health components over the past several years. And so it's been really cool to watch that grow. I've been doing this work for a long, long time. I don't know necessarily about like a national ranking, but I do know that it's really embedded into the sport culture at the Olympic levels, the professional levels, at the collegiate level even. You know, even mid-major, smaller schools, even D2, D3 schools have sports psychologists that they work with. So it's really embedded into the fiber of our sports. Would love to see that more at the youth levels, at the high school levels. I think we're starting to shift that just by the number of teams that will reach out to want to do sports psychology work. But I think the more that we can just see it as good tools for life, and it's going to help athletes be more available, like less injuries, just enjoy their sport more. It's going to help performance. Just a really good way to think about investing in the athletes.
Dr. Erin Haugen is a licensed clinical and sports psychologist based in Grand Forks. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much, Erin, for joining us on Main Street.
I'm honored to be able to chat with you.
Main Street continues on this Thursday. I'm Craig Blumenschein, pleased to be joined by Annie Beck. She's a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science, and that's in Bismarck, of course, a beautiful, beautiful place. Annie, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much, Craig. Pleasure to be here.
We are going to feature the North Dakota Gateway to Science periodically here on Main Street on Thursdays, and today we're talking about what's upcoming. So we want to have the list. We want to know who can come and what they can experience.
Yeah, absolutely. So in addition to our gallery and exhibits that we always have, we also have special events, some that come one time and some that are ongoing. Some of our upcoming family events, we have Grandparents Day on September 7th.
Hey, I fit in that category. What do I get? What are I going to do?
So bring the grandkids. There's going to be a lot of different fun activities for you to do. $10 off the grandparents pass if you choose to do that. And yeah, it should be a really fun day for everyone.
Okay, that's on September 7th, so that's 7th. Coming here this weekend.
That's
all right,
coming up close.
Lots more on the calendar.
Absolutely. We have also our preschool discovery hours. So we believe our learning is for all ages. So our youngest learners, we have special ones dedicated toward them every month. So the second Wednesday and following Sunday of each month, we have a preschool discovery hour. Each month, they are a different theme. So September's theme, apples and leaves.
Ah, perfect for this September. Time of year. Yep,
exactly. And so we have a lot of different activities for our young scientists, like apple stamps, leaf shadow tracing, using microscopes, all different kinds of activities. And then also for families, we have Worldwide Day of Play on September 27th. So we believe that learning is fun and that play is the learning of childhood and the work of childhood. So on that day, we invite everyone to come out. We have a number of special events for that day, such as building with our cardboard tools and our rig-a-ma-jigs. So engineering tools. We have our large watershed map that we're going to be using with robots. And we have science of taste and vitamin C testing. We have animal tracks and bubbles in our outdoor explorium, all different kinds of fun things. And then on October 3rd, we have International Observe the Moon Night. So this is an evening event where you'll have the opportunity to do lots of different hands-on activities. So learning about the moon, our solar system. We have a digitalis dome where we'll be playing 360-degree movies about the moon and space. And then, of course, we love being with our kids and with our families, but sometimes adults need to get out and play and experience science with themselves. So we do have a science event each month that is geared specifically towards adults. And this one is STEAM, Science, and Sub-Zero. It'll be on September 23rd. And we are partnering with Nordak Sauna Company. Our guests will get to experience steam saunas, cold plunges, and observe how those temperatures affect our body. And they're gonna learn about that science of heat and shock therapy as well.
Annie, I've never had the courage to do a cold plunge, have you?
Well, not officially in this sense, you know, jump in the river when it's probably not a good season to type things, but.
That sounds like a good event. Many events at the North Dakota yeah. Gateway to Science are upcoming. Annie will join us each and every Thursday here on Main Street for at least the near future. We're happy to have them. Annie Beck is a STEM educator at the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Annie, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me.
Still ahead on Main Street, Dave Thompson and I review this week's news of the region, and Becky Purdames has a new business called Caring Transitions. She focuses on seniors needing to downsize with a twist. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Extra, extra, read all about.
Main Street continues with our weekly look at the news here on Prairie Public with our good friend, our news director here, Dave Thompson. Dave, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig. Good to be here.
Dave, an interim committee begins studying nuclear power for North Dakota. What's this about?
This is very interesting, and the discussion came up during the session proper when they were talking about it. There has been some discussion as all these data centers are coming in, the demand on power, and there's been a lack of, you know, new coal plants. There are some natural gas plants being built. But then they heard that there was going to be this portable nuclear reactor that's going to be in Saskatchewan, pretty close to the U.S.-Canada border, and it's put in by Sask Power. That got people thinking, what about nuclear as an option? North Dakota does have some uranium deposits, too, so, you know, it might be a good fit. So they had this study, and when they created the study committee, they had a lot of demand from legislators who wanted to be on it because everybody's curious about nuclear energy and whether or not North Dakota could have it. So they only had so many slots on that committee, and a lot of people had to be turned away, which is very interesting for an interim study committee.
And the interest was from both sides of the aisle, not just
Absolutely.
Democrats, not just Republicans. And Dave, is this generally received with a lot of hope, or is there a lot of kind of going on defense right out of the gate with nuclear power in North Dakota?
There's a little bit of both, but really it's more curiosity at this point.
Nuclear waste is the issue that is on the front burner for many legislators?
That is correct. And that came up in the hearing in this first committee meeting. What are you going to do with the waste? And of course, right now, Xcel Energy has two Minnesota nuclear power plants, and the waste is being stored on site because they don't have a place to put it. They were going to, you know, put it on Yucca Mountain down in Nevada, but that didn't work. So that is going to be an issue going forward, and that is one of the issue topics that this committee will take a look at. Okay, if we're going to do this, is there a place in North Dakota we can store it, or do we store it on site, or is there a way we could ship it out to some other kind of storage facility? And how are they going to, you know, come up with new ways to store spent nuclear waste?
Here we are talking about data centers. Certainly in Harwood, it is a big issue. They've had meetings recently. We've covered them here on Prairie Public. Mm-hmm. Dave, what's the latest with this, I guess, idea that North Dakota is going to need a lot of power?
And that begs another question, Craig, is what about the existing power grid? Can it support doubling the power? So there are efforts in both what is called the Southwest Power Pool, the SPP, or the Midwest Independent System Operator, MISO, to upgrade power. At first, it was to get more wind on the wires, but now they're talking about, you know, maybe baseload power. You need power that's going to be there when the wind stops blowing and the sun stops shining. So where do you get the baseload power? Right now, natural gas is being talked about, nuclear is being talked about, and keeping coal plants that may have been scheduled to be retired, maybe keeping them on for baseload power too. So there's going to be a lot of discussion on that too.
A lot of new demand. Dave, what was new in your eyes this week relative to the data center proposed near Harwood?
Now, it was interesting to me that there was a lot of discussion about it, and there was an attempt by Fargo to annex that land, which I thought was very interesting. And I'm sure there's a lot of tension between Harwood and Fargo right now.
We'll watch that going forward as well. Dave, I want to turn the page just a little bit. We've got a couple of other issues I'd like to talk about. The Department Certainly. Of Corrections, they're offering funding now for programming and reentry services. And this is about $1.5 million.
That's correct. And if you have a jail facility and you want to start a new program, you've got an idea, then you can apply for funding to help that happen. Now, the idea of, you know, trying to cut down on recidivism by training people to be productive in the workforce has a lot of support, but there are also skeptics, and you heard that during the legislative session. There were a few skeptics saying, really, do we want to do this? Well, yeah, you do, because we right now have a prison system that is overcrowded. You know, there's no room at the end, so to speak. So they're talking about ways, okay, we'll get people trained, we'll get people to be used to be back in society and have a way to have a productive future, you know, make some money, things like that.
Dave, the new chairman of the State Board of Higher Education, that's Kevin Black, has now met with legislators, and he wants to work with them on the higher ed funding formula. Mm-hmm. What's new there?
Well, what is new is that their legislature has a committee set up specifically to tweak funding formulas, and there's been that formula in place. And now they're saying, does this really follow the student? They want money to follow the student. So they're going to be taking an in-depth look at that funding formula. And the thing that really got me is that one of the legislators brought up the idea that, you know, he read some of the board self-evaluations that talked about, you know, certain board members favoring certain institutions, a parochialism. And Kevin Black said, yeah, we want to eliminate that. We really do want to think system, not parochialism. And that, you know, got a few headlines when that was said. So, but you've seen that certain board members get on the board and they're all for one institution. So they want to get rid of that and really think more like a system.
Dave, you went to a Human Services Committee meeting this morning talking about homelessness. What did you hear?
What I heard and what struck me right away. Jessica Thomason, who is working for the Department of Human Services, she's the executive director of the Human Services part of it, and she started a presentation by all the data shows is that in 100% of our North Dakota counties, we do have homelessness. And I think that caught everybody a little off guard, because they were thinking it might be just a Bismarck or Fargo or city issue, Grand Forks, Minot, that type of thing. No, they said, we have homelessness in every county in North Dakota, which is very interesting. And how do you combat it? Well, there's going to be some strategies. And one of the things that they've come up with is, if you are really strapped for cash and you can't afford housing, well, then we might send you assistance, but it might not help so much. So there's ways they're going to try to come up with some ways to help support affordable housing in North Dakota, and it might be outside the big cities as well.
Dave Thompson and I review the news on Thursdays here on Main Street. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You bet, Craig. Take care of yourself.
I'm gonna tell you a story.
The Bush Foundation is accepting applications for the 2026 Bush Fellowship, September 2nd through October 7th until noon central. The Bush Fellowship invests in people and their capacity to do more good for the region. Bush Fellows are committed to leading equitably to create large-scale change. Up to 30 leaders from any sector receive $150,000 to support their self-designed leadership plan. More information can be found online at bushfoundation.org.
Today on Main Street, we're joined by Becky Perdames, a longtime North Dakota resident, single mom, and a new business owner who's bringing caring transitions to Bismarck and Dickinson. North Dakota's senior population is growing quickly, up more than 20% in just 5 years, and in many rural areas, families often struggle to find support when it comes to downsizing, moving, handling an estate, and Becky has lived that search for purpose herself, and she's channeling now her energy and experience into helping older adults and their families navigate life's big changes with care and compassion. Becky, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
So what is it? Tell me what Caring Transitions is for our listeners who are unfamiliar with the brand.
What we are is stress relief for families. So when families are dealing with a transition of most, we focus on seniors and their families, but we can help any age of person. When families are facing transition, it's almost never in a really anticipated situation where someone is like really excited about moving or really excited about selling the farm or really excited about moving to maybe a continuing care community. A lot of times
we've had an illness, we've had an accident, something we didn't anticipate.
Right. And so we're there to help with the belongings. Families get overwhelmed with the amount of stuff. What are we going to do with it? What can we take along to the new place? Where can we donate things? Where can we sell anything? How are we going to manage all of this stuff that has maybe accumulated in a house for like 20, 30, 40 years? And we're in the business of helping deal with all of that stuff to take that stress off the family. That way they can focus on the loved one or on grieving or on future plans, and we'll deal with the stuff for you.
Sure, this could be when maybe after mom and dad have even passed away, and now all of a sudden family who may not live in the area need assistance or help, or a person who needs to downsize, who needs to come back to a less complicated home but doesn't have family to help. Is that who you help as well?
Absolutely. There are a lot of situations that require someone to transition to another place. A lot of times it's a health related thing. Sometimes it's just, we don't want to be mowing the grass and shoveling anymore. But there's not always family members around to help, or those family members are busy with their own kids and their own lives, and they want to obviously lend a hand or be involved, but the manpower and the kind of grind of getting all of that figured out is an added maybe stress on an already stressful situation. And so they reach out to us and we can help them navigate all of those things.
So we come to the place where we need to get rid of things, so to speak. I don't need those. Other family members don't need those, or I don't have family members around to give things to. We call you. What happens next?
So everyone is always eligible for a free consultation. So I'm going to come over and I'm just going to see what we're dealing with. And I'm going to find out, what is your goal? Is your goal to get this house cleaned out and get it on the market? Because the value really is in the home. Yes, the stuff has some value, but the value is in the home. So if we want to just get it cleaned out so that we can get this home on the market, we're going to, you know, really focus on that. But maybe you have a lot of things to donate,
or maybe you can help folks donate things as well.
Absolutely. Yep. And we really focus a lot on sustainability. We want to keep things out of the landfill. So if we can give things a second life somewhere else, we're going to do that before we're just going to toss things in the garbage. We're going to help you sell the things that have value, kind of matching the treasure with the treasure hunter. Seniors, they really care about their things. They worked hard for them. They've kept them for a long time. And it is a little bit hard when the grandkids don't want it, the neighbors don't want it. If we can find someone else who really would love that collection.
Let's go ahead and talk about what CT Bids is. I want to reintroduce you also to our listeners, Becky Perdames. She's now bringing Caring Transitions to Bismarck and Dickinson. And CT Bids, Caring Transition Bids, is this online auction that doesn't have people who just happen to come over, maybe wanting some ice cream and popcorn on a Saturday to look at things. It's really a nationwide now audience that you're selling to, so to speak.
Absolutely. It's our own platform with over 850,000 registered users. That means when we have an auction live, it's not just the people that show up that day, it's nationwide. And all bidding starts at $1. And so it just goes up from there. And you are able to sell almost anything that you want to sell. And with the sales run for about a week, and then we will handle shipping anything out to people that don't live locally. We'll handle the pickups for people who are kind of going to come and get the things that they've purchased. And it's such a great platform because a lot of times at in-person estate sales, yes, those auctioneers do an awesome job of trying to get the price up, but people are like, when is it going half price? When can I get it for less? But in an online format, people are bidding against each other. So those values are going up.
Who's the decision maker here?
Every decision is still up to the family. We're not gonna make any decisions for you. We are going to let you know from our experience what the best option is. So we know what sells well. We know what doesn't sell as well. We know the donation places and what they take and what they don't want. So we can advise, but it is always up to the individual client what they ultimately decide to do with their things. And it's important to think about, like, what is our ultimate goal? So if our ultimate goal is to get this home cleaned out, so we can get it on the market, maybe the dining room table with 6 chairs isn't going to sell for a huge number because things like that just don't sell. People don't want them as much. But if the person who buys it is going to come and get it and get it out of the house, well, that's a win because our goal was to get the stuff gone.
And you get to help arrange that. I don't have to worry about it.
You don't have to worry about it.
There's the value there. You're a business person, Becky. What's in it for you?
We really feel like we have a valuable service to offer. And so we obviously are looking to have really great people, offer really good jobs for people. So many people so excited to work for Caring Transitions because they want to do meaningful work. And we're providing a great service. And in doing that, hoping to grow a really great business that I can share with my kids someday.
Sure. You're bonded and insured, correct?
Of course. Yes.
So if someone wants to learn more, they need to plan, or we're at this place now where I need help with my parents' things or my aunt and uncle's stuff. What should I do?
So you can go to our website, Caring Transitions of North Dakota SW, Southwest is our title, or just caringtransitions.com and put in the location and it'll find me. And then you can put in information and then schedule a consultation and I will come to your house and we will figure out what the best route is. You can also send me a message on one of our Caring Transitions Facebook pages. You can give me a call. We're really excited about spreading the word about Caring Transitions here in North Dakota. Like I said, there's 400 locations nationwide, but we're the first here. So right now I'm in the business of getting the word out and making sure people know that I'm here and I want to help them.
Do you primarily serve Central and Western North Dakota?
So my territory is the whole Southwest quadrant of North Dakota. So just a little north of 94, a little east of Bismarck, and then to Montana and South Dakota. That being said, no one else in North Dakota is doing this in North Dakota, so I can essentially serve anywhere. I really hope to, right now, all my team members are in Bismarck, although my mom lives in Dickinson and she helps me all the time. But I would love to get a team built in Dickinson also so that if we get a job in Bowman, we're not driving 2.5 hours down there. A team that's closer could go down. Because I don't want to turn anyone away. My territory is large. And I feel like if someone's in my territory, I really want to serve them. So it is my goal to get enough people helping me so that no matter if you are 150 miles from Bismarck, I'm still going to come help you.
That's Becky Perdames. She's bringing Caring Transitions to rural North Dakota. She's helping seniors and their loved ones navigate downsizing, moving, or estate transitions with dignity and care. You can get in touch with her for free. And Becky, thank you for answering this call. My family has been through this. It wasn't easy. We felt like we were in the jungle by ourselves trying to figure all this stuff out. We had no one to call like you. So thank you for being with us today on Main Street.
Thank you so much.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Books on Broadway and Dakota Soda and Coffee Company of Williston, featuring coffees and a wide variety of books for children and adults. Books on Broadway, the independent bookstore for independent minds.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 4th. Cattle drives were a major economic activity during the 19th and early 20th centuries. Cattle were driven from Texas to railheads in Kansas and Nebraska to be shipped to eastern stockyards. When big Texas ranchers took note of the good grazing in Dakota Territory, cattle began arriving in 1876. On this date in 1915, an article in the Dickinson Press detailed how a large cattle drive arrived in Dakota Territory in 1884. The cattle were owned by the Long X Ranch in Texas. The herd left Texas in early spring and reached McKenzie County in September. This was before the days of barbed wire. Enormous herds, owned mostly by Texas ranchers, grazed loose on the prairie. That caused problems for small local ranchers whose cattle often mixed with the new arrivals. The Long X made efforts to avoid hard feelings. They even provided saddle horses to nearby ranchers to help them keep a closer eye on their own stock. But it was a thankless task. The newspaper described the challenge of rounding up loose cattle as like keeping away the mosquitoes in the springtime or flies in midsummer. The Long X employed two teams of about 25 cowboys each. Most came up from Texas with the herd. They branded calves in the spring and rounded up cattle in the fall, driving the herd to the Eland Stockyards, 4 miles west of Dickinson. There, the cattle were loaded into stock cars and shipped east. The work of the cowboys was far from glamorous. They worked 7 days a week in all weather and spent nearly every waking hour in the saddle. They also took turns standing night guard. The newspaper noted that virtually every cowboy is a physical wreck by the age of 35. A new Long X herd arrived each year for the next 3 years, but the harsh winters were discouraging. The winter of 1886 was especially brutal. Many ranchers, including Teddy Roosevelt, lost 60 to 70% of their herds. Cattle drives to Dakota Territory came to an end. Movies and TV shows about cattle drives tend to focus on the journey from Texas to Kansas and Nebraska. But thanks to old newspapers, we know North Dakota played an important role in the cattle industry of the Old West. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
Hi, it's Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. You may have heard that prices for used vehicles are up. That car you've been thinking about donating to this station?
That car could be worth hundreds of dollars or even more in support.
If you don't need it, donate it. It's easy, it's free to you, and the proceeds help us bring you the news.
Learn more on this station's website.
Just go to prairiepublic.org, open the support tab, and choose vehicle donation.
Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has had some wins on his policies to, quote, make America healthy again. Some states have passed laws banning food dyes and requiring labels on ultra-processed foods.
We have been the busiest, most proactive administration in HHS history.
How Kennedy is trying to reshape America's health policy on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by LiveWire, providing live event audio, video, lighting, staging, and scenery for in-person, hybrid, and virtual events, serving clients throughout the Upper Midwest and nationwide. More at LiveWireNow.com.
And that wraps up this Thursday edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this in all past episodes of Main Street wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, what are the biggest challenges facing Gen Z? Then at 7 p.m. Central, it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. We hope your NFL fantasy team is all ready to go. Those Survivor League picks have been made. And best of all, have a great North Dakota weekend. We'll look forward to seeing you again Monday, right here on Main Street.